Few subjects in school can make people cringe quite as much as the study of math. Our next guest works hard to overcome the cringe factor, spreading the gospel of math far and wide. Keith Devlin visits the Southern Oregon University campus for a pair of lectures yesterday and today. He is the executive director and one of the co-founders of the Human Sciences and Technologies Advanced Research Institute at Stanford University. Everybody who knows it calls it H-Star. And Keith's voice might sound familiar because he has appeared on NPR many times, often on Weekend Edition, as the math guy. Keith Devlin is the author of close to 36 books, a pile of articles, and has been recognized by the California State Assembly for his contributions to math. Keith Devlin, a pleasure to meet you.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Nice to be here.
Thanks for having for coming in. Between books and radio work and other outlets, you put quite a bit of effort into making math, appealing to a broader audience? How hard is that?
It's extremely hard. And the weird thing is, most of the people around the world that do it had a British education, so I don't know what it was about a British education, but it sort of set us up for doing this. I've been doing it ever since I got into professional mathematics, and the reason is I'm just a kid from an ordinary working-class family in the UK, and what turned me onto mathematics was reading popular books. There weren't many back then, but I read them. I was bored in the school math classroom, who isn't? I was bored, but I read these popular books. It turned me on to mathematics, so when I became a mathematician, I said, hey, I'm going to give back. I'm going to write the kind of books that inspired me when I was an early teenager.
And what's the key to success for those books? I mean, what are the ways in which they and you have appealed to people who might think math is boring and you know, got bored in math class?
You start with people and what people are interested in, because fundamentally, every human, not everybody is interested in mathematics. I realised that early on. But everybody's interested in other people. You know, we call it gossip. We talk about them, we read about them. So if you begin with the people and the people's story and the people's interests and the people's needs and desires and hook the mathematics onto that, then at least you can get them in through the first 30 minutes or the first half page. At some point, you've actually got to deliver something that's going to be of interest to them. And the audience does drop off steeply, but you can keep some people in. And quite frankly, my real goal is to find that kid like me that I'll hook, that will stay in the business and keep going and become a mathematician.
And how many people do? I mean, how big is the field?
I think the field is about, well, it depends how you define the field. If you mean people who call themselves professional mathematicians, it's probably about 25,000 in the US, I would guess. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about people who use mathematics in a deliberate way, it must be hundreds of thousands. And if you talk about people who use it in an implicit way without realizing it, it's every one of us.
Well, the use part is a big one. I mean, everybody, I think, who's ever had a kid struggling with algebra or you know, something even tougher in high school has dealt with the question of, like, how am I ever going to use this in my life? And once you're done talking about tax forms, where do you go? I mean, how do you make the case for where math is going to matter?
None of us, I mean, I'm a mathematician. I don't deal with the tax forms anyway. I either use TurboTax, and when TurboTax doesn't do it for me, then I hire an accountant to do it. And the reality is we don't do that kind of mathematics anymore. This is all this business with the Common Core. There's a misunderstanding about why that was introduced. It was a recognition that we carry around with us in our pockets a computing device that can do anything we'd ever need to do in the sense of computing. So those computing skills, which were crucial for 1,000 years, disappeared from the necessity league about 20 years ago. Nobody ever needs to know how to do accurate computing anymore. However, we all have at our disposal an unbelievable powerful computing devices in our pockets, in the cloud. Using those devices in our everyday lives, in our professional lives, that requires a fairly sophisticated, what we now call number sense or mathematical thinking ability. You need to be able to reason about numbers and reason logically with machines, with devices. So people no longer need to master long division. We use a computer for that. But knowing when you need to do division and knowing whether the answer the computer gives you is right or wrong, that's a crucial skill. And the Common Core was actually designed to develop that new skill, that 21st century skill. What happened to the Common Core is it got badly implemented in some places, it got misunderstood, misrepresented, and there's all of this furor. But if you go down to what the Common Core was trying to do, it was saying, look, everybody, the 21st century is not like the 20th and the 19th. We need to change mathematics education.
Let me go at this in two parts then, because the first part is you're talking about we don't really need to know how to add and subtract numbers anymore. As long as machines can do it, why bother? Is that the essence?
We don't need to know how to do it and get the right answer. We need to know what it's involved. We need to know how it works. And we need to be able to have a sense of whether the answer's right. But actually doing the computation, we don't need to do that. So if you can just deal with one and two digit numbers, you can get a sense of these things and then let the machines take over. It's the same with, it's like automobiles. Everybody needs to know how to drive a car safely. Hardly anyone needs to know how to build or to maintain a car. Experts build cars, experts maintain cars. Everybody needs to know how to drive a car safely. Everybody needs to be able to drive mathematics safely in today's world.
So we need to know how to turn left and how to turn right, but we don't need to know how to build the steering
mechanism.
And we need
to know what the danger signs are.
Uh-huh.
Because mathematics is a powerful tool. It's like a sword. It's got two sharp blades, one on each side. It can be very useful. It can be very dangerous. You can cut yourself badly on mathematics. And the big financial crash of a few years ago was when our banking system cut itself badly on mathematics that they did not understand.
Really? Yeah. You mean because they were making assumptions that
they were using algorithms that would tell you. But the people that designed those algorithms, the quants, they said all along, there's a 95% chance that these algorithms will give you the right answer. There's a 5% chance that they won't. And the bankers ignored them. And then that 5% came up, the roulette wheel rolled, and we were in the 5%, and everything crashed. And when it crashes with mathematics, it crashes big and it crashes fast.
Is that partly a translational issue? I mean, when a quant, you know, somebody who knows math is going to say there's a 5% chance of failure, does the person who doesn't understand math think, well, that means I got 95% chance of doing this well?
I think that's exactly what they did think. And most of them were lucky because they made a lot of money before the thing crashed.
Wow. So interesting quote in the lead up to your lecture yesterday about what can you do with a math degree, which is you say math doesn't solve all problems. In fact, it solves hardly any.
That's true. Yeah. And science in general does that. Mathematics helps us to do things. It helps us to do things in useful ways. The world we live in would not exist without mathematics. We wouldn't have Google. We wouldn't have Facebook. We wouldn't have radio. We wouldn't have automobiles. We wouldn't have medicine system. Yada, yada, yada. All that's built upon mathematics. So it's unbelievably useful. But let's not get seduced to think that it is right all of the time. The technologies that are successful build on parts of mathematics in little areas where the mathematics gives us the right answer. In the rest of the world, it doesn't. And you need to know that when you use mathematics.
Keith Devlin is a Stanford professor and the math guy on NPR from time to time. He's our guest in the studio here in the Jefferson Exchange. We'll talk about math in much greater depth in the next segment of the Exchange. You're welcome to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange with Keith Devlin and you in a minute 15. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about math with Keith Devlin, who is one of the best guys in the country to talk about math with. He is the math guy on NPR from time to time. He teaches mathematics and a whole lot more at Stanford University and heads up the Human Sciences and Technologies Advanced Research Institute. You can understand why people call it H-Star, because it's a mouthful otherwise. All right, so you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you have some questions about mathematical issues in your life or questions about mathematical education issues there. You can share those with us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The list of ways in which you, Dr. Devlin, have used your math skills is long and varied. And I noticed on that list, animal math capacities.
Yeah, I got interested in this. The question I started with was, how does the human brain acquire the ability to do mathematics? Because mathematics is only a couple of thousand years old. Numbers are only 8,000 or 9,000 years old. So all of the mathematics that we do is recent. Well, evolution takes longer than a few decades. It takes millions of years. So what my question was, what are the mental capacities we use when we do mathematics? To do that, I looked at all of the literature on how the brain does mathematics. And a lot of that literature is not just for humans. It's for animals and various other kind of creatures, even, you know, sort of shrimp and pigeons, not just the apes, but even sort of low-level creatures, if you want, like ants. And what I discovered was there's been tons discovered in the last 30 years about all sorts of creatures that do sophisticated mathematics. I mean, the most obvious one is bird migration, or the various kinds of butterflies that sort of fly around. They navigate the globe very effectively. That's trigonometry. It might not be trigonometry the way we do it. On the other hand, trigonometry done in my iPad or my iPhone, that does its trigonometry different from me. So you can do mathematics in different ways. Humans do it one way with paper and pencil. Our iPhone does it another way. Birds can do trigonometry to navigate. So lots of creatures have mathematical abilities. And when I read the literature, I actually wrote two books. I wrote a book called The Math Gene, which was how did humans acquire the ability to do mathematics? And it's a hypothesis. Who can prove that? But all of the material that didn't go into that book made a second book, which was called The Math Instinct, which was about how all sorts of creatures like cuddly cats and our friendly dog at the hearth do mathematics in their everyday life.
Okay, I can get it with people with migrating animals, but how is the dog and cat going to be doing math?
The dog one was interesting because dogs can solve calculus problems. When you throw a ball to a dog, and if you throw it at the beach where you throw it into the water, the dog does not run directly to the ball if it's in the water. It runs along the beach first because it's faster to run on land and then swims. In other words, it minimises the distance it has to swim and by maximising the distance it has to run. So it knows it's faster on land than in the water, and it takes the exact path that calculus tells you should take. So the dog's instinctive behaviour solves a problem that we would use calculus to solve. So in that sense, the dog is better at calculus than we are, because it doesn't even have to be taught that.
That is amazing. Okay, one of the things you listed on your resume is I have to ask about working for the CIA on a post-9/11 national security project. Yeah. What'd you do?
That was one. I mean, the big question they came to was, when they looked at the data, they realised all of those guys that crashed the planes, they were on the horizon people, they were in the databases, they were known suspects, at least most of them were suspects in terror cases. So the problem was, we have all this information, our data collection is great, we have the information, how do we find those little nuggets of information in this ocean of information? And they, within a few weeks of 9/11, a lot of us got phone calls from defence contractors. I didn't interface directly with the CIA, it was still a defence contractor, but I got a phone call saying, we have been hired to sort of do work, and the question was, how can we make a better job? Would my kind of mathematics I know help? Nobody knew, but basically they trawled everybody and said, let's try to see how we can do it. So I spent several years simply trying to answer the question, what can we do to make it easier for intelligence analysts to sift through mountains of data? What kind of systems can we build to help them do that? It was an incredibly difficult problem. We didn't solve it. It's one of these cases where even a 1% solution will help. If we can just get slightly better, people's lives can be saved.
Well, it's interesting you bring up 1%, because it reminds me of Dick Cheney's remark about if there's even a 1% chance we're going to get attacked, we have to move. So obviously people use math in very different ways, politically and governmentally. Yeah. But that's an amazing sort of thing to think about, is if you're raking in tons and tons of information, how are you ever going to find the part you need?
Well, the reality is you're not. So all you can do is stack the odds in your favour. And that's why there's this really big debate about whether the NSA should be surveilling everybody. You know, I'm on the side that says no, because you've got a fraction. If you're surveilling everyone, there's so much data that you can't really get into the ones you want. So there's a real issue of how you do it. So I'm on the side that says use the NSA's computing power to look in depth at people who have risen above the horizon as a threat. Don't worry about the farmer in Illinois who's just a farmer in Illinois, because that just is noise that could be eliminated at the beginning. But, you know, am I right? Is the NSA right? Who knows?
Keith Devlin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the math guy from Stanford, known as the math guy on NPR. You talked a little bit about Common Core, and so let's get us into the education, the teaching of math part of this. You think the Common Core had the right idea but the wrong approach? Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely had the right idea. I don't think they realized, it was sort of politically naive, I don't think they realized the work that had to be done in sort of setting the stage for this and explaining why it was done. Because you got all of these posts on Facebook, people saying, here's a Common Core. You see, what they didn't realise was that kids go home and maybe they realised it but didn't take into account. People try to get help from their parents. They try to get help from a teacher who hasn't had an upgrade course in several years. And the people that were having to implement it in the parents not only didn't know why it was being done, but they didn't have the background to do it. Because the reality is, we need our kids to learn mathematics in a different way from the way we learnt it. Because in the day we learnt it, we didn't have computing in the cloud and a powerful iPhone in our pocket. That changed the world so fundamentally that it means today's kids have to learn mathematics in a different way. They absolutely do. It's pointless teaching them to do things that they can do by pulling a device out of their pockets. And that just wasn't prepared well when this thing rolled out.
I'm still trying to find a really fine line here, and forgive me if this is getting a little too into the weeds, but if we need to know how, for example, addition and subtraction work, and when the appropriate function is addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and need to get a sense of whether the answer is right, we really need to know how to do the process.
You need to do it, but remember that there were some classical algorithms, the classical way you and I were taught to do arithmetic and to do division and multiplication. That was a system that was optimized to make it possible to get the right answer fast with a difficult problem. The kind of methods that have been taught in the Common Core are saying, yes, you will learn to do addition, but you learn it in a way that is not so efficient for doing the computation, but is optimized to help you understand why that computation gives the answer. So these exercises that people get uptight about, They have been carefully designed, knowing everything we know about how the brain learns mathematics, to make it possible to do mathematics in a way that helps you understand it. Because I guarantee you 99% of people who can do long division could not explain why it works. And that's what's important now. You get a machine to do it, you'd better know how it's doing it and how it works.
Oh, because you need to be able to find where the flaws are.
You need to be able to see what's happening, and you need to have a good... It's like your car. I mentioned the automobiles. Well, you don't need to be an auto mechanic, but you need to know roughly what's gone wrong when you hear this clunk, 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 clunk down in the engine, and you know that that engine's about to seize up. You need to know the danger signals in an automobile, and the same is true with mathematics.
Are you encouraged by the emphasis on STEM these days, where the M stands for math?
Yes, I am, but I think it should certainly be STEAM, because you need art in there as well.
Science, art? Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The STEAM, I think, is better than STEM.
Uh-huh.
And the A stands for arts.
Because we're stimulating different parts of our brain.
We're human beings, and we are social creatures. We are artistic creatures. You know, mathematicians are artists of their own type. They're emotionally involved. They're excited. I think my excitement comes through whenever I talk about it. I have the same excitement with what I do as Picasso did with what he was doing. So you shouldn't separate the social, the emotional, and the artistic from the mathematics. And indeed, mathematicians are better mathematicians if they're artists and creative people as well. And most of them are. Many mathematicians are musicians and painters and so forth.
What's your art?
I'm a bicyclist. Actually, I used to play drums in early on. I really focused my art in cycling in a very intense, interactive way. By cycling, I mean road biking or mountain biking in a way that brings me in connection with the world around me. I live in the Bay Area, so I cycle. I sometimes come up to Oregon and do mountain biking up here. I go cycling in the most beautiful parts of the world. So for me, cycling is a deep religious experience, communing with... I'm beginning to sound like a Native American in the traditional sense. I really sort of would like to commune with nature on a bicycle.
Sounds great. Keith Devlin, again, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the math guy who shows up on NPR from time to time, teaches at Stanford University. I read a Huffington Post column where you criticized what's taught in schools as algebra. What's your argument with that?
Yeah, algebra was invented in Baghdad in the 9th century, and it was a way to do arithmetic in a fashion that scales. Around that time, people were starting to develop trading methods, and you needed a way to do arithmetic that was scalable. That was what algebra was. Algebra became this rather arcane system of manipulating symbols. But we need to remember that that was just a way of doing it before computers. Today, we all have devices on our computers that are algebra machines. We call them spreadsheets. A spreadsheet is the modern implementation of algebra because it does arithmetic at scale. What you do in column A, you can have done in column B, C, D. That's algebra. Before we had computers, you had to learn to do it by symbols, and it's really complicated and hard. And of course it's boring, because when you do algebra by symbols, you're trying to do what a spreadsheet does. But you're not a spreadsheet, you're a human being. Of course people find it boring. We had to do it that way for 800 or 900 years. We don't need to have to do algebra that way anymore. You have to know the algebraic language to go into physics and science and engineering. So it's important to learn the language of algebra. But is it important to be able to solve quadratic equations? No, I know. It's just no longer important. You need to do enough of that manipulation of symbols to understand how they work and to be able to make effective use of machines that do it, including spreadsheets.
A couple of emails here, one from Debbie in Talent, who asks, are there other countries that teach math better than we do in the United States?
The ones that became famous for doing it were Singapore and Finland. They're very different systems. Finland is a very sort of westernized free democracy. Singapore is quite the opposite of that. They get there by different means. They're certainly better. Some of the Eastern European countries are certainly better. Hungary is better than that, Poland. A lot of that is just cultural tradition. The countries that do better... What you find is that teaching is a respected profession. It's a more better remunerated profession in the sense of the society that they're within. And it's just sort of done better. The reality, we make a lot of complaints about the US education system. The US is diverse. One of its great things is it's very varied. You go to some parts of the United States, parts of Massachusetts and California, parts of Oregon and Washington State, you will find mathematics teaching and mathematics students every bit as good as you can find anywhere else in the world. The US fundamentally doesn't have an education problem. It has a poverty problem. The reason we tend to get low results is we have large areas of the country country with enormous poverty, and those kids are just not getting a good education. That's at the heart of the American crisis in education.
Because they're coming to school from rough environments.
And the schools are in poor environments. The schools don't have the background, the support. The schools don't have the funding. The schools can't attract the good teachers. You've just got this cycle of poverty. That's actually at the root of the American education crisis.
The poverty part.
The poverty problem.
All right.
If we solve that, there is still a problem, but it's an easier, more tractable problem.
We have from Jeannie in Medford. She wants to know about this old math riddle. Three men go to stay at a motel, and the man at the desk charges them $30 for a room. They split the cost, $10 each. You're familiar with
this
one?
Yeah.
Okay, so go ahead and finish it.
If you work at those problems, these are the kind of problems that those new Common Core methods are supposed to help you solve. Because what happens there is your problem is posed in such a way is that you end up adding and subtracting the wrong things. It's not that the math is wrong. It's that you don't understand how to solve that problem. It's turning the problem about the clerk in the hotel, turning that into mathematical symbols. That's the part that's tricky. Computers can't do that. Humans have to do that. If we learn mathematics the right way, those problems will disappear because everybody will look at the problem and say, I shouldn't be adding this to that. That makes no sense. I should add this to that other thing.
It's a very holistic view of math, then, to step back far enough to go, okay, this is not the correct question, even.
That's actually the way we are in mathematics now. For thousands of years, we were so obsessed with computation because the only way to do it was do it yourself. Humans had to do the computation. We didn't have time to step back and do the big picture stuff that humans not only are good at, but we enjoy doing. Now we can do that. We're now in an era where everyone can enjoy mathematics because it comes creative, it becomes human. It's about human problems. How can I use mathematics to solve this human problem? Using computers when I need them.
So in addition to what you do teaching, you started something called BrainQuake, which is video games of math, essentially, for kids, apps that you can get on mobile devices and
yep.
computers and so forth.
Yep.
And so tell us about the whole drive there.
Okay, so yeah, BrainQuake, we founded that a couple of years ago. We brought out our first app about a year and a half ago. It's a fairly revolutionary approach. A week ago, we were awarded a $900,000 grant from the Department of Education to build on what we've done. So we've got some confirmation now that we're going in the right direction. Most of the math education video games, there are about 20,000 math apps on the App Store. Most of them are actually very naive. They simply say, kids like to play video games. They hate to do mathematics. Let's put some mathematics into a video game. It's a shotgun marriage, sometimes referred to as chocolate-coated broccoli. We put some game chocolate around the mathematical broccoli, and we'll try to use kids' enjoyment in the game to do the mathematics. That never works because the kid just comes away thinking, this math is terrible and it's stopping me playing this game the way I want to play it. We started to develop video games. We said, let's take a problem in mathematics and let's build a game around it. Instead of expressing the problem in symbols on a piece of paper, we'll express it as a video game. We've got hundreds of thousands of kids around the world with our first app solving, at age 8, systems of simultaneous linear equations using the mathematical methods that mathematicians use. The reason they can do it, and they couldn't do it in the math classroom, is when you see that on a piece of paper, it looks awful in symbols. You put it on a screen on an iPad with gears, it becomes possible to do it. So our games are built on the principle. The way I like to describe it is you want to learn a music, the best way is to get an instrument. We are building instruments to learn mathematics. So you can learn mathematics by playing mathematical instruments the way you can learn music by playing instruments. So we are a company that builds mathematics instruments to play mathematics.
I would have been disappointed if you didn't have plush toys of the main character, was it? And you do.
We have plush toys, yeah. We took out the trademark on the plush toys. They're actually educationally important. It's known that if you have something like a little character with plush toys and things, people can latch onto it. It makes it human. It touches in to our emotions, and that's absolutely critical.
Wow. Oh, the fuzzy toy helping you with
that. Little
math.
Fuzzy toy, yeah.
We have an email here from Jeffrey in Ashland. He says, I quit formal education over the frustration of algebra taught dryly. I was an artistic kid and I saw no connection. I later became a 3D animator and wished I had found a way to absorb it.
Oh, yeah.
I later apologized to the teacher and offered to come to her class and explain the importance to students that they might not see.
Yeah, that's such a familiar story of people that get turned off and it's an interface problem. You know, computing before the days of Macs and iPads and things, the interface sucked. It was really difficult. That symbolic interface to mathematics, it's not an interface that's optimized for learning. That interface is good for doing mathematics, not for learning mathematics. Mathematics actually has an interface problem. And just as in computing or music, better interfaces make it possible to do it. So with mathematics, where you can develop interfaces like our games, that makes it more accessible.
About 2 minutes left with Keith Devlin. Here's a call from Avalon in Gold Beach. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I am one of those people that was born without the math gene.
I struggled
through school. I mean, straight A's and everything else except math, and I had to really struggle to get, like, C's. And I, when Keith Devlin comes on NPR, I get so excited because this man makes mathematics seem like this totally intriguing subject. And I'm thinking, I wish I'd had Keith Devlin as a teacher when I was going through school. It was horrible. Yeah. It was just horrible. I was so stressed.
It's, as I said a moment, it's an interface issue. The traditional interface with symbols and textbooks, that's a good interface for the sort of the techie people like myself. But for most people, that's a terrible interface. We no longer need to rely on that interface. We can use games interfaces, app interfaces, human interfaces. We've learnt enough in the last 20 or 30 years. We have the technologies now to provide alternative pathways into mathematics that means you would no longer have that bad experience.
Evelyn, thanks for sharing that experience. Sorry it was bad, but glad to hear you're able to get good things from Keith Devlin, as we just did, too. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Absolutely my pleasure.
Keith Devlin has another lecture coming up this afternoon at 3:30 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University called Too Good to Be True, Unraveling the Mystery of Some Recent Studies of Video Game Math Learning. I guess you'll be talking about Brainquake there.
Absolutely.
All right, Keith Devlin, thanks again for joining us.